You're listening to the Growing Leaders Podcast, episode number 15. Well, thanks for joining us on today's episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. Today, we've got Dr. Tim Elmore in the studio, and we've got a special guest joining us via phone today. And he is Mike Ford. He is the Associate Dean for Campus Life at the University of Wake Forest. He has been there 32 years and quite much more that can be said about him. But Tim, I'm going to let you do a more in-depth introduction.
Thanks, Jim. And Mike, thank you for joining us today. I have outlined some questions that I've wanted to ask you for a long time. It's been great to become your friend over the years. And you have been there over three decades. So you have seen quite a few shifts of students at Wake Forest, haven't you?
I've seen several generations, and it's always, they keep you fresh and on your toes.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump right into it. Talk about what you do specifically at Wake Forest. You have the opportunity to lead and coach some very, very great students. In fact, I remember your colleague, Mary Girardi, once said you call it workforce sometimes at a Wake Forest. What do you do on that campus?
Right, Tim. Workforce is an apt description, but Mary and I, we work in campus life. She's the dean. I'm associate dean. She and I lead a team of 15 colleagues who love our jobs. We work each day on the front line with our wonderful students and do a lot of student development kinds of activities. Everything from the welcome week and new student orientation programming. Lots of things around leadership development, lots of things in the area of service and student activities, organizations. It's just everything that's kind of outside the academic or curriculum.
Yeah.
So that's our domain.
And didn't you mention even judicial? Anything outside the academic world.
Yeah. It's a residential campus, so we really do look at, learning happening beyond the walls.
Absolutely.
Outside and in the, corners and in the different venues around campus as well as in the community. So it's kind of a holistic approach.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about what you do. Well, let's kind of kick things off. What are some key insights that you've been learning as you lead students from Generation IY? You know, these are the kids that are born since 1990, a little different than the 80s kids. You led the 80s kids, through the 1980s. But right. Talk about some of the things you've learned as you've seen shifts happen in the student body.
Yeah, right, Tim. I would say there's three things that come to mind. One is, I think in this, fast-paced culture that we see, not only in our adult world, but in college, people are always kind of moving, from place to place and topic to topic. And it really struck me that today's student really has some trouble with really being alone. And having some time just to kind of be by themselves without their technology. Just sitting and reflecting and kind of listening to what's in their heart, or listening to what someone has said to them. So that's, I think, one of the things that has been different, and I'm not sure it's been that helpful, but we try to give them space and time to be alone and be reflective.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you and I have talked before about the whole value of solitude. We run from solitude. We run to noise and clutter and people, and yet we need that to learn critical thinking, to learn, just to be self-sufficient and self-regulating, I think.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree, and I think that's where you make meaning in your life is in those quiet times, and you make that integration and that connection.
Yeah.
A second thing that just struck me is, our students today, they're they're ambitious, at least the ones at Wake Forest, and mm-hmm. they want to make a difference. They want to take initiative. They want to kind of put their ideas out and kind of make their mark, but they're always looking for that sense of approval mm-hmm. and that affirmation. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a, you know, there's that piece of them that says, I really, you know, want to, you know, fly. I want to get out there and spread my wings, but I need to kind of get the support and the sense of, you know, affirmation that this mm-hmm. is, you're doing the right thing. So
yeah.
That's where I think we have a great opportunity to mentor and coach and so forth.
Absolutely. Good, good.
I guess the third thing that strikes me is for our students today, the thought of commitment, you know, really locking in on something for a period of time, I sense that it scares them a bit. A lot of the students that I work with, they want to keep their options open, mm-hmm. You know, and there's so many options out there too, and for them to choose from, but they're oftentimes hesitant to really, you know, jump in and say they're committed
yeah.
to this cause or this program, and this, you know, sometimes the staying power is not as strong as yeah. as it could be.
Mike, you hit the nail on the head. In fact, I'm hearing this from so many higher education institutions, not to mention K-12 schools. The ability
right.
to stick with a commitment when the glitz and the glamour are gone. And by the way, none of us love that. But there's so many things in our culture today they're going to graduate into that require commitment when the glitz and glamour are gone. Marriage, for instance.
Yep.
You know, you've heard me make this prediction that are we going to see 5-year marriage contracts? Right now, there are 2 countries in the world that are offering 2-year marriage contracts because
wow.
we're just not able to stay with it when it's boring or when there's nothing in it for me. And I that's it concerns me because while the world may be changing, there are certain timeless things, I think, that we need to teach in a brand new way to a new generation that doesn't understand them, perhaps.
I would concur, yeah. So those are, you know, those are 3
okay.
kind of insights that I have about today's students.
Well, Mike, you've heard me say this before. I love what you're doing there on that campus, you and Mary and the team that I have met with before. Love what you're up to. Love what your heartbeat is, too, not just the minds you have, but the heartbeat. But I want to shift gears real quick. This is the part of you and perhaps your life and your background that many of our listeners wouldn't know. You grew up under 2 great leaders in your home, and it may surprise some of our listeners. Who were your parents?
Well, that is a big part of me, Tim, you know, your family and my family. And it's something I'm very proud of and I feel is, you know, really shaped who I am today. But we don't always put it out there, but I feel like it's important to share that my father and my mother, who are kind of my two heroes, my father is Gerald Ford, the 38th president of the United States, and my wife, and then his wife Betty Ford, who was is quite a distinguished leader of women's issues and the equality. So Gerald and Betty Ford.
Amazing. Now, I know you don't say it's amazing because you grew up under them. They spanked you and they scolded you and did all that stuff. But I remember growing up in the 70s when we all got to know your mom and dad.
Right.
I was a teenager, but I was definitely old enough to remember his presidency. It was a very tumultuous time. He followed President Nixon, who left office early, and your dad was thrust into this presidency. He didn't really run for office for that particular office. He was thrust into it. So I would love for you to just talk as candid as you possibly can. You were a young adult during those days, but what were some of the greatest takeaways you learned under your father? Let's talk about your dad first.
Okay. Well, as you said, Tim, my father did not aspire to be president of the United States, but history and I think the divine kind of guidance there kind of put him in that place.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that was part of his his character was that although he, you know, wanted, actually aspired to be the Speaker of the House, he was, you know, the U.S. representative for 25 years from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was the minority leader of the House and got very close to getting that majority and being Speaker. But when Watergate kind of unfolded and Nixon resigned from the White House, my father was called to that role of of leader of the country. And the thing that struck me is, you know, he did not back down or shy away from that challenge at all. Mm. He really felt that he was well prepared to step in there during that very critical time in our country. So I really admire him for his, you know, sense of calling, his sense of duty, his sense of being prepared
and rising to the challenge
for that moment.
Yeah.
Not that everything was easy, but he was ready to step up to the challenge.
Let me back up for just a second for some of our listeners that may be, you know, what you might call young whippersnappers. Let me give a history lesson real quick. I will say this probably quicker than you. I believe your dad was exactly what our country needed in that moment. Watergate unfolded. Spiro Agnew, the vice president, stepped down. So was not your dad then called up to his role? And then President Nixon stepped down. So it was a pretty quick move. He had to rise to the occasion. But because of Watergate, there was great distrust in government. I know we go through that in waves, and it's come and gone and come and gone. But your dad took office when it was probably one of the most difficult times to be the leader. I mean, it's like, no matter who you are, we don't trust you. I mean, I don't know what you would say. I won't let you comment, but he had to really earn the trust in a very difficult time when people were just wanting to know, what are you thinking? Why are you doing that? And what's behind that? And then when you pardoned Nixon, oh my gosh, would you talk about maybe what you were feeling in those times as a son, a protege, an emerging leader yourself? Do you remember those days, and what do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very fresh in my mind. But just to kind of comment on that period of history, I mean, the distinction that many historians make is the country moved from the imperial presidency with Richard Nixon, which is very secretive and, you know, kind of command and control, to the open presidency with Gerald Ford, where you had this individual, my father, who was very comfortable in his own skin. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the Midwestern kind of all American guy.
Played football at Michigan.
And the Eagle Scout, and you know, worked as in the Yellowstone National Forest. You know, did all the things that many identify with many of our citizens. But he came in and really threw open the doors and the windows and said, you know, I want you to see me, who I am, and the challenges we have. And he had press conferences, and he, you know, he explained the budget by himself, and he, you know, he did things that people hadn't seen for years, you know, as in the presidency. And so I think that created that trust and that new spirit of openness. Speaking of the pardon, you know, that really struck me because, you know, he certainly didn't talk to me about, you know, should I pardon Richard Nixon?
That was
not our conversation, but we did talk a lot afterwards about why, you know, what was the thinking there. Yeah. And I think it demonstrated to me, and historians have affirmed this, a lot of great courage on his part, you know, moral courage. You know, Aristotle wrote that courage is the central virtue.
Yeah.
For without it, all other virtues fall aside.
Yeah.
And in that time in history, I think the courage to, you know, say, you know, we need to, you know, pardon this person who has, you know, wronged our country and misled us. And he has suffered a great deal, and we need to kind of put that history and the Watergate all behind us and move forward as a nation and heal. You know, even realizing that act that, you know, my father, the pardon itself probably cost him the presidential election in 76. So, that was a big, huge
issue.
Example.
Well, and one way I summarize what, because I was an onlooker, you're in the family. I'm just watching it as a teenager back then. But in many ways, I do think leadership changed under your dad. He was a pioneer. And you're right. Under the Nixon regime and before it was command and control, I think your dad opened up the trust and transparency from command and control to trust and transparency where he was open. He was the everyday guy. He was like your next door neighbor. Good leader. But there he was, like you said, the budget, everything else. And then I think we ought to pardon this leader. I'm not saying what he did was right. I'm just saying we've got to move on. And I think it's exactly what our country needed. And so cool that you got to grow up under a dad where you could talk about that after it happened and hear his reasoning. Now, let me shift gears real quick. You have also told me more than once, I had two good leaders I grew up under. What are some of the greatest lessons you learned from your mother, Betty Ford?
Can I mention one other thing about my dad?
Oh, please, yes.
That was a lesson learned, and that was the whole importance of civility in terms of doing governance and doing, you know, leadership. And I, as I mentioned, he was in the House of Representatives 25 years, and you know, those are long, you know, hard years of committee meetings and. Yeah. Appropriations and you know, trying to work out compromises, you know, across the aisle with the other party and you know, he constantly really worked to build bridges and build, you know, strong relationships even with people that he maybe philosophically disagreed with or had different, you know, policy positions with. So, so there was a respect, there was a sense of even friendship with someone like the speaker, Tip O'Neill, good friends, played golf together, but, you know, they were trying to, you know, beat each other up on the floor over, a funding issue or something.
Yeah,
but
sure.
it was the spirit of governance, of civility that you could, they could disagree without demonizing one another. And that has taught me a great deal about leadership.
Yeah, and much needed today. Okay, well, thank you, Mike, for sharing that. And I have a great respect for your dad. Now, let's talk about your mom.
Hero number two.
Yeah, right. Hero number two. Talk about her for a minute.
Well, my mother, I think it was best kind of described when my brother Steve talked about my mother in the context of a fleet of ships, and my dad, he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy in World War II and served on a aircraft carrier as a navigation officer. And so my dad said, well, if dad was the aircraft carrier in the fleet, mom was the hospital ship. And that is so true in how she was the one who came alongside us as kids and other friends and family members to really show great compassion, empathy, and love for, you know, when we were, struggling or needed that encouragement. So I think that was one quality that she really brought to our family and into our community. The other, after my mother and our family addressed her addiction to alcohol and prescription drugs in 1980, she really became kind of a changed woman in not only becoming clean and sober and so forth, but also she came forward as a very forthright
spokesperson,
kind of open person. I mean, you know, just keep things real, tell it like it is, don't sugarcoat it, She was, you know, really one who would, you know, get to the heart of the matter. And I really felt that was a quality that she brought to the family too, is her openness and her, you know, just frankness. And it was, you know, very helpful to us.
It's been said many times about your mother that she really opened the door, not just for women, although certainly for women, but for many to come clean with their addictions or whatever. And it is, I mean, look, good grief. All of us have things that we don't like about our lives or maybe are embarrassing, but so cool for her to say, you know what, I could go ahead and finish my life and never say this, but I'm going to say it to pave the way for others. And what a door she opened with the clinic and other things, just helping perhaps millions of people do the same.
Well, also with her breast cancer and bringing it out of the closet and, you know, sharing her, you know, her physical need there and the treatment. It really did save a lot of women's lives. So she was a trailblazer, that's
she
for sure.
She was. Think about it. This was more than it was about 30 years ago. That was new. We didn't talk about some things back then. You swept it under the rug or you just, you know, suck it up and just live with it or whatever. So she really did. She really did. Now, I want you to talk about something else. I'm going to set it up, and I want you just to make as little or as many comments as you want to give. I'm always intrigued with the idea of leadership and personality or temperament. It seems to me like Richard Nixon had a certain temperament. It was that command and control. No apologies for it, but he was who he was. And you know, Ronald Reagan was something else, and Jimmy Carter was something else. But your dad, for me, as a young leader at the time, showed me that you don't have to be command and control. You don't have to have this type A, high D, drive, 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 drive. Even though your dad was a very ambitious man, would you talk a little bit about the role of temperament in that sense? I don't expect you to be a psychologist, but any temperament can lead. You just got to be comfortable in your own shoes, don't you?
I agree, Tim. I think, temperament does play a big role in leadership. And you know, I think it's very situational, too.
Mm-hmm.
Think certain situations call for a particular type of, you know, temperament.
Yeah,
whether
demeanor.
It is that type D, where you need a little more strong, you know, just charge up the mountain or the hill and take the hill. And more directive, and I think other times it really needs more collaborative and more open and more kind of building, building trust. And I think that was more my father's temperament. He was just someone that was very, you know, he was ambitious, but he was not going to run people over. He really wanted to build a team and find the best people, to bring together and solve the problems of the country and not take the credit. You know, his ego was not you know, at the forefront. So I feel like temperament was critical for my dad to be successful at that time. And I think it is something to really pay attention to as you look at different situations of organizations. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, a couple more last questions. So this all happened. You were thrust into the limelight of America as a young man yourself, recently married, I think, and now you are a leader in your own right. You are Michael Ford, and I would love for you just to talk a little bit about your own leadership. First of all, what would you share as perhaps a best practice at Wake Forest? That Wake Forest does with students, maybe that out of your department or whatever, what are some things just to encourage other people that work with the next generation as leaders?
Okay, so looking here at Wake Forest, as I said, I'm really blessed and privileged to be surrounded by some great colleagues on our team and throughout the university. But we really do think in terms of a leadership culture is the way to go. It's one thing to have a bunch of a list of programs and different activities that you just kind of roll through and check off, and that has not been our been effective or been our way. So rather than programs, we really focus on relationships and building those relationships across departments with our faculty, who are really the backbone of the university and the academic side. But they're critical to our success as we are critical to theirs. So they're in the culture. We partnerships with other departments on campus, even athletics and alumni and academic advising. But then partnerships with our students and their parents and also their our alumni. So it's this organic culture of way of developing people, trying to holistic development, find them what is their potential and trying to bring that out. So one of the best practices that we've developed is a program called My Journey, and it is it's a network of programs kind of designed to challenge and support students through their developmental transitions, from first year student all the way to their fourth year or fifth year, and we've kind of connected those together, and we've got it's called My Journey, and we have first year is the Awakenings year, and the second year is the Discovery year, and the third year is Connections, and the fourth year is Celebrations, and in each of those years, it's not like you're locked into that, it's fluid. But you have certain opportunities, experiences that are set up for them to develop their potential through those 4 years. So has really worked well, and of course we're utilizing social media all along the way too, which is
absolutely important. That's a component.
A second program, I think best practice would be. Around the whole idea of, and this ties into leadership culture, but I think the leadership model that we try to actualize is that of empowering students we start with the student, who they are and what they bring to the campus, but to really empower them to find their passion and their calling.
Yeah.
And what is it that really lights them up
gives them
life. So one of the questions I always ask students is, what do you do or when do you find yourself when you feel that you're the most alive or full of life? And have them talk about that.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of guide and lead them to different opportunities and experiences on campus. And then you follow it up with, equipping them and training them at appropriate places, and then, putting them in roles of responsibility, coaching them, mentoring, giving feedback, and then actually putting them as leaders, themselves, peer leaders to train, equip, and actually replicate themselves. So
that's so cool.
That's the model.
You know, what raced across my mind as you were talking the last few minutes is, in so many ways, we just talked about how your mom and dad moved our country from the control economy to the connection economy. In so many ways, what you just described at Wake Forest, that's what you've done there. Instead of trying to control the students, how about connecting with them? How about finding out what makes them come alive and then send them down a track that's naturally going to give them ambition and passion? And it's just a natural reflection of what's been cultivated in your life. And I love it. I think it's spot on. And I really do think you guys at Wake Forest model that, not control, but connect. That's the key. Well, Mike,
empowerment. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. It's empowerment. We have time for one more question. And really it's just the question I love to end these podcasts on for anybody. But if you had just one piece of advice for leaders of students who might be listening right now, what would that be?
One piece of advice,
that's hard
to do,
yeah.
but I think, reflecting on my father, my mother, and who I am, and the advice would be to be authentic and be, kind of be yourself. and you know, and not try and project or put forth a facade, but be real. And, you know, students are smart. They, you know, they read people well, and they are attracted to authenticity. And I believe that, you know, while we cannot be a student's best friend, nor should we be their best friend, we still can be their friend.
Yeah.
And if we're vulnerable, and if we are, you know, real, and they see that there's a common, you know, humanity here, that will give great impact and opportunity to influence those young students. So
absolutely,
that's the word.
Good word, in fact. Michael, thank you so much for spending some time with us and just walking down memory lane and sharing your thoughts and ideas. They've been fabulous, and I appreciate you taking the time so much today. Thanks.
Well, it's been a privilege, Tim. Thank you, and we love what you and your growing leader staff are doing there for all of us and for the young people of our culture. So keep it up.
Absolutely. You too. All right.
Thanks
again, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. What a special opportunity we had to hear about Mike and his journey as a leader and then how he's putting that into practice today. Real quick, we want to point out a new item that we've got in our library for you. It's called Case in Point. And Tim, why don't you tell us just a brief moment about that?
Jim, we're excited about it because it's very different from what we typically have offered in terms of books or DVDs or events. Case in Point is actually a series of case studies, real-life student case studies. Neil Best, who's at Geneva College, and I have kind of put this together. We've put a Habitude with each one of the case studies, but it enables a group of student leaders with staff to talk through real-life situations, kind of a what would you do in this situation, but process it. Rather than a lecture, it's really a situation. And I think it's a great, great learning point. And then with the Habitude at the end, it's a great teaching point as well. We're making that available on our site called Case and Point.
Absolutely. You can go to growingleaders.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you can click on the link store. And then it's right there on the top for you. Like Tim said, it's called Case and Point. What a great opportunity to create some real conversations about some real scenarios and how that we need to play out as a leader. So that wraps it up for today. We hope you all have a great week.